Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. He comes to us from the UK. His name is Henry Hemming. His last name is spelled H-E-M-M-I-N-G. And I had him on a couple of years ago, 2021, to talk about a book I was interested in because of its tie to Aleister Crowley. The title of that book is Agent M, The Lives and Spies of MI5's Maxwell Knight. I highly suggest people check that out. But it just came to my attention that he published a new book. If you're watching this on X or YouTube or Rockfin, you'll see a title of the book and the cover of the book. And it just was published April 2nd, 2024. And the full title is Four Shots in the Night, A True Story of Spies, Murder, and Justice in Northern Ireland. And I was listening, it's kind of the first time I've really listened through an audiobook. I was delighted to get a copy of that audiobook and listen to it. It's really good. It's very dramatic and it has a lot of different accents and involvement. It's much more interesting than some of the other audiobooks I've listened to. So congrats on that. But this is not his first book, and he's written for The Economist, FT Magazine, Washington Post. And his books have been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor. And if you're seeing this through what's live, like even the New York Times commented on the book, and Daily Express compared him, delivers a read worthy of Le Carre himself. So I think that's a very high compliment. And it is a really interesting story. Maybe Americans don't know that much about this, the troubles in Northern Ireland, really kind of a longer term conflict. Arguably goes back centuries, but flared up in the 70s and 80s. But like I said, I just want to read out some of his other books for people. One is In Search of the English Eccentric, Misadventure in the Middle East, The Ingenious Mr. Pike, Agents of Influence, A British Campaign, A Canadian Spy, and A Secret Plot to Bring America into World War II. That's in 2019, so you can check that out. But again, his website is his full name, Henry Hemming, and we're going to talk about Four Shots in the Night. But it is an interesting story. Really enjoy. There's a lot of intrigue, and it's almost kind of like Casablanca or something like that. A lot of real interesting conflict, but he can talk more about that. So Henry Hemming, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really, really good to be back. It's been a few years.
Yeah. It's been too long. So for people who may not have heard of our earlier show about Maxwell, your book about Maxwell Knight, maybe you can talk about your background and your books and what led you up to the research and publication of Four Shots in the Night.
Yeah, my background is writing about spies, writing about intelligence, about espionage. But to be honest, this new book it's a departure. It's different. It's different to other things that I've written in the past. And up until now, I've concentrated really on Second World War spies. And there's a conversation that I had about 5-6 years ago. And it was with someone who knew a great deal about intelligence studies and espionage and the inner life of spies. And he said to me something like, you do realize the biggest story in the history of British intelligence over the last 70 years is one that's hardly been told. And of course, I was gripped, I was intrigued. And he went on to say that this story was the story of spies inside the IRA in Northern Ireland during the Troubles and the role that they played in bringing this conflict to an end. So that was my way into this. And yes, it's not my specialist subject, Northern Ireland and the Troubles, but I decided to have a go, to throw myself into the subject and do my best to research it, to understand it. And that began this extraordinary journey, if you like, of research in the archives and libraries, but also, crucially, and this is what really set this whole experience apart for me, meeting people who had experience of being in the region and operating during the Troubles and talking to them about their stories. So people from the IRA, people who grew up in Northern Ireland, had lived there, knew the people I was writing about, and then also people who'd been working for the British. And to begin with, I was intrigued by the whole subject, you know, spies in Northern Ireland. Who were they? How many of them were there? What were they doing? But everything changed for me when I heard about one particular spy, and this is a man called Frank Hegarty. And this is when the whole outline of a book began to appear in my mind, and it became in some ways a true crime story. What I heard about Frank Hegarty was this, that he was a British spy. He had been killed in 1986. And the rumor was that he might have been killed by another British spy. So someone who had infiltrated the IRA just like him, but had been given the order by the IRA to take this man's life. And that was the moment I thought, right, this is something I want to investigate. This is something I want to know more about. And so that's really where the kind of genesis of this book lay.
And what's the kind of conflict for people who don't know the Troubles? At the intro of this book, you kind of go into it. There's a lot of murders or bombings. There's a, you know, Ireland, the IRA wants all of all 12 principalities in Ireland to become one, right? So that's one big republic. And then there's the Northern Ireland, which is really governed by the UK, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You've got the six counties in the Northern Ireland. I guess maybe the best way to think of the Troubles is to think of these three really distinct ingredients. And a lot of people think it's the Troubles is about just one thing. It's just about, let's say, unification, Northern Ireland becoming part of the Republic of Ireland. But really, I think it's more accurate to think of it as in these three different ways. It begins as something else. It begins as a civil rights campaign. And it begins really on the streets of Derry. And what you have are mostly Catholics, but also Protestants marching in the streets. And they're asking very simply, not for unification, but for equal rights for both Catholics and Protestants living in Northern Ireland. So they want equal rights. They're hugely inspired by what's been happening in America. So it's the civil rights campaigning there, which inspires people in Northern Ireland. And as this campaign begins to gather steam and momentum, there's a reaction. There's a reaction, and it comes mostly from people within the Protestant community in Northern Ireland. So here you've got the second element of this conflict, and that is this sectarian conflict that begins to develop. And put really simply, it's Protestants, including many of those in the police, in conflict against Catholics in the region, who begin to see that this is the chance they have to get equal rights and to win some of the power that they've been denied historically for so many years. And the third ingredient is the one that comes about after some of the sectarian violence begins to get out of control. And that is the British Army arrives in the region and begins to patrol on the streets. And very soon after that happens, about 3 or 4 months after that, there begins to be this campaign against them, this counterinsurgency. And you've then got this third ingredient. So you've got a counterinsurgency, you've got a sectarian conflict, and you've got a civil rights campaign. And mixed together, you've got the Troubles.
Right. And that was, it's very unusual for the British Army to be deployed like that, right? I think that's correct, right?
Totally. It's something that very rarely happens in British history. And the reason's pretty obvious. This is not their jam. They're not trained to be patrolling British streets, and they don't know what to do. They're not trained as a police force. And so the British government at the time is deeply conflicted about this. Should we send soldiers onto the streets in Northern Ireland? Is this a mistake? Where's it going to lead? Nobody quite knows, but they do know that the situation is beginning to spiral out of control, and that the police in Northern Ireland are not able to cope with what's going on. So they make this decision. They decide it's probably in the best interest of everyone there to send in the soldiers. And what's interesting is that to begin with, it seems to be working. So for the first 3-4 months, the violence abates, there are fewer casualties, and there seems to be the beginning of some kind of peaceful resolution to what's been going on. But then, after about 4 months in early 1970, things begin to change.
Right. And so then there's the conflict, the bombings, and there's also kind of the spy warfare. Like the view of from what I took from the book is that the view of from London was that intelligence was going to win eventually win the conflict. Is that right? Can you talk about
that? I mean, well, the interesting thing is it took them about 10 years to come to that conclusion. And for the first 10 years of the conflict, they thought it's about tougher policing. It's about more soldiers. It's about everything apart from intelligence. And of course, there was an intelligence operation early on in the Troubles. But it's only about 10 years into this conflict that there is this fundamental change. And there are people high up in the army who decide, actually, let's see what we can do, making intelligence the priority. And so there begin to be more spies. The army takes on more spies. The MI5 presence in the region begins to grow. There's even a special former head of MI6 is sent over just to oversee this new intelligence operation. And, you know, just for a moment, taking a step back, this is new. This has never been tried before. There's never been an attempt like this to try and end a conflict using spies on this kind of scale. And just to fast forward for a moment to later on in the conflict, I just want to give you a sense of the size of this operation, because it's one that is astonishing, I think. There was somebody called Father Dennis Bradley, who suddenly in the 21st century, he was given access to classified government documents, and he was allowed to see intelligence, which gave an idea of just how many agents there were operating in the region. And we've all heard of, let's say, the Cambridge Five. And I remember sort of hearing this interview and thinking the number was going to be maybe 10 or 20. And he said there were 800 secret agents operating in Northern Ireland at any one time during the Troubles. And some people think that figure is an underestimate. So you've got this, the scale of it is unusual. And because it's never been tried before, there are things that almost inevitably go wrong. There are things which aren't expected. And, you know, to get to the kind of the nub of the story that I'm telling in Four Shots in the Night, the things that go wrong are when you have too much intelligence. And as a spy master or an agent handler, you have to decide which intelligence to ignore and which intelligence to act upon. And sometimes the people running these agents were left with these incredibly difficult decisions, where they realized if they acted on the intelligence they were getting, they might endanger the life of the person who'd given it to them. But also by not acting on it, they could endanger someone's life because they'd be the victim of an attack. And this is where it becomes morally really complex and difficult. And if there's one thing that became really clear from the research that I did, it's that a lot of the men and women who are running these agents didn't always have the adequate training or a sense of the legal guidelines that they need to be following when they're faced with these impossibly difficult life or death decisions. So the scale of this operation is huge. The moral dilemmas are incredibly difficult. And at the same time, many historians are beginning to concur that one of the reasons the Troubles ended when they did was that there were so many spies in operation at that time. And this was making it harder for the IRA to function in the way that they wanted to. And this probably played a part in ending the Troubles.
And maybe you can talk about the IRA, the importance of the IRA, and some of their, from their standpoint, their successes. Like they blew up the Earl of Mountbatten, I think off the coast of Northeastern Ireland. Maybe you can talk about them.
Yeah. So the IRA, absolutely. I mean, 1979 is when the IRA killed Lord Louis Mountbatten, a member of the royal family. And what's interesting is that on the same day, there was another attack that they undertook, which killed a series of soldiers at a place called Warren Point. And in some ways, that had even more of an effect. I mean, yes, the headlines were all about Mountbatten. But in terms of the effect on the army, the effect on the British government and their way of thinking about it all, the Warren Point attack had more of an impact. So by this point, what is the IRA? The IRA is a paramilitary organization. It's made up of, by this point, it's been in its latest incarnation. It's been going for about 10 years. And most of the people inside it by that stage are survivors. They are good at what they do. They are security conscious. They're extremely hard to track down. They are absolutely dedicated to their cause, and their cause is to try and, by military means, remove the British Army from Northern Ireland, try and defeat the British Army. That's the goal. And it's been the goal since pretty much the start of the Troubles. But the one thing that's changed for those inside the IRA by this point is they're beginning to adopt a strategy called the long war strategy. So they're no longer thinking, right, we're going to win in the next couple of months, or we're going to win by the end of this year. They're beginning to think, actually, if we can just stick in there, we can just keep going for many years. There'll come a point where the Brits are forced to negotiate with us and we can have some kind of political compromise, some kind of political solution. Maybe that's the way to get a result. So around about that time, there is this fundamental shift deep inside the IRA where they begin to have a different attitude towards what's going on.
Right. And wasn't there an attack by the IRA on 10 Downing too? Like, they did very audacious.
There was. Yeah. Absolutely. There was, just to name two extremely well-known attacks. One was an attempt to take the life of Margaret Thatcher. That was in 1984. And that was down in Brighton. That was they knew that the Tory party was having its annual conference, and a bomb was planted in the toilet, or rather behind the toilet, the room in which she was staying, or very nearby. I don't know the exact details. And the bomb went off successfully. It it killed five people, but it did not kill the main target, i.e. Thatcher. And then less than a decade later, the IRA managed to fire mortars at 10 Downing Street and again came incredibly close to assassinating a British Prime Minister. So yeah, the IRA was audacious. It was an extremely competent and successful organization in terms of its ability to deliver these high profile attacks, but also so many attacks inside Northern Ireland. And these were aimed at all sorts of different targets, whether it was British soldiers, whether it was local police, or on many occasions, it was just local Protestants or anyone who was believed to have some kind of connection to the British state. I mean, one of the stories I remember writing about when I was writing Four Shots in the Night is a story of someone called Joanne Mathers. And she was a young mother who, to earn some extra money, was going door to door collecting information for the British census. And this, I mean, I don't actually know if you have this in America. This is happens once every 10 years where all information about people living all over the country is gathered on one particular day. And she
we have kind of a census. I don't know if that we have a 10-year census.
Yeah. It's does it involve people going door to door gathering information or anything like that?
Yeah, no, I mean, we go door to door here, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how much of it, how detailed of information it is. Is yours detailed?
It's fairly detailed. And anyway, this young mum was taking part in this. But for some members of the IRA, even taking part in that was seen as collaborating with the enemy. So word got out that she was going door to door. And the order came down to have her killed. So she was murdered. And that actually, one of the last people to see her alive was someone who was so affected by what happened that he then decided to begin to work for the British as an undercover agent. And it's one of these fascinating stories. He then becomes an important figure within Sinn Féin. He passes on crucial information. And he also plays a small part in this story that unfolds in Four Shots in the Night.
Was that Scappaticci? Was that him or was it somebody else?
It's a guy called Willie Carlin. Willie Carlin, his life was saved later on by Freddie Scappaticci. Gotcha. So Freddie Scappaticci, the guy who's, I mean, some of your listeners may know him as Steak Knife, who's been in the news recently.
Can you talk about that recent news and kind of about Scappaticci? He's kind of an interesting character,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So Freddie Scappaticci, he is a Belfast bricklayer. He's recruited by the British Army. He becomes an agent in the late 1970s, and he's asked to join the IRA. Now, he was previously a part of the IRA, but he got kicked out. So after he's recruited by the British, he agrees to try and get back inside the organization. And he does this. And then soon after he gets inside the IRA, he's asked to join this one particular unit inside the IRA, and it's called the Nutting Squad, or its official title is the Internal Security Unit. And this unit is the part of the IRA devoted to hunting down spies. So what they do is they interrogate people in the IRA who are suspected of being a spy. And then if the order comes from up on high, from the likes of McGuinness, for that person to be shot, to be killed, then the Nutting Squad is most likely to do it. And Freddy Scappaticci is, at one point, he's given the instruction. He's told, right, we found a spy. He's called Willie Carlin. He's over in Derry. You need to go with the Nutting Squad. You need to go and abduct him. You need to go and interrogate him. And then we'll make a decision on what happens to him. And what he does is Ron goes straight away. He delays. And he immediately makes a call to his handler. And he tells his handler, look, they're after this man, Willie Carlin. I think you need to let him know. You need to get him out of there as soon as possible. And that's what happens. And the message is passed on. Willie Carlin gets a call from his handler. And he's told, look, you've got maybe 12 hours to get out of your house. You need your family out of there as soon as possible. So that's what they do. Willie Carlin and his family pack all their things. They're removed from Northern Ireland. They start a new life in witness protection. And then when Scappaticci and the Nutting Squad arrive, they find, of course, that the house is empty. And all of the other people in his unit are furious. So Scappaticci, he's an interesting and a notorious character. So he's part of this unit. It's believed that he took part in 14 murders.
Wow.
14 murders, which is an astonishing number. And there was a police investigation which began quite recently, began in 2016, called Operation Canova. And this was centered purely on Scappaticci. What does Scappaticci do? Did he commit murders while he was acting as a spy? Did his handlers know about this? Did they turn a blind eye? Were they right to do so from a legal point of view, from a moral point of view? And this police investigation just last month delivered its first, what was called its interim report. And that begins to describe some of its findings. And although it hasn't given us any detail on exactly which murders Scappaticci may or may not have been involved in, the overall conclusion of this report is that Scappaticci probably took more lives than he was responsible for saving, and that mistakes almost certainly were made. So he's that's why he's in the news.
But it's a very murky environment. Like, there were certain things, like I remember listening to a story of a British officer going to a bar, and they sussed out that his accent was just a little off, and then he disappeared. Like, you could literally get disappeared out of a bar in the wrong place at the wrong time in that environment. I mean, and this McGuinness guy, like, it's interesting because the troubles took place, but it didn't happen in a historical vacuum, right? Like, you write about his influence by Michael Collins and Michael Collins' kind of ruthlessness well. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And it's so important. You know, when does the troubles begin? You could say it begins back in the 17th century. It's or even before that, but it's a huge mistake to see it in some kind of historical vacuum. And for Martin McGuinness, I guess one of the kind of early references for him is what happened earlier in the 20th century with Michael Collins and his campaign against the British during the Irish War of Independence. And Michael Collins is this brilliant, charismatic IRA leader. And he's the person who's in charge of intelligence for the IRA during its campaign, its counterinsurgency campaign against the British Army. And one of the things he does, which really sets him apart, is he has this absolute zero tolerance policy towards spies. He sets up a unit, it's called the Squad, and it's devoted to not just tracking down spies, but then killing them. And it's believed to have killed hundreds of people. Not all of them were spies. And this had an effect. This had a huge impact on people's willingness to work for the British, to supply information. And Martin McGuinness, in the late 1970s, he knows that the IRA has a problem with spies. They've got to do something. And it's pretty clear that he's inspired by Michael Collins when he decides to set up this new unit called the Nutting Squad. And he makes the decision to be as ruthless as Michael Collins was. And he very much admired and wanted to emulate parts of Michael Collins's career. So that, yeah, the history certainly informs what's going on in the Troubles.
Right. And he, I mean, there was another guy from Sinn Féin that he was friends with too, right? Weren't they go on walks together? I remember hearing that. Like they were, their operational security was very important, right?
Yeah.
Face-to-face, like almost like a mob, like face-to-face contact, no bugs or anything, right?
Exactly. And I think you're talking about Jerry Adams.
Jerry Adams.
And, yeah. And so yeah, Martin McGuinness and Jerry Adams, there's an amazing podcast interview that I heard the pair of them talking about this, talking in some quite bleak terms about this period in their life when they both went away for these long walks and quite often would go for long walks out of Derry. I would start at the house of Martin McGuinness's mother and then walk up to this ancient hilltop fort overlooking this incredible panorama over parts of Ireland. And I've been there. It's a fantastic place to be. It's hugely inspiring. And while they're up there, they were trying to figure out, what do we do? What direction do we take the IRA? How are we going to make it free from spies? And that's really where the genesis of the Nutting Squad lies. Those long walks that they took through the kind of the damp Northern Irish countryside. And when I was writing Four Shots in the Night, that was a really interesting moment, being able to visualize those walks and to understand what they were seeing as they were trying to make these incredibly difficult decisions and trying to work out the future of the organization.
It must have been an incredible moment too, because they're making these like earth-shattering decisions for Ireland in the context of like this place, this famous castle that was mentioned by Ptolemy. It's like, this is like we're really in an Irish environment making these decisions for the nation state. It's really something else. But also there was a lot of jailings, and I remember there's allegations of like torture in British jails and things like that that were also part of this whole environment in Northern Ireland. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. There. So early on in the Troubles, the British Army makes quite a few mistakes, and like really big mistakes, like tragedies occur. You've got Bloody Sunday, you've got the you're referring to the Hooded Men incident, where men, innocent men, as in they'd not been charged, hadn't been prosecuted for anything, were taken. Their heads were covered with hoods, and they were subjected to various forms of torture, and this was in order to try and extract information. And this is, yeah, this is part of this really kind of like gung-ho, over-the-top reaction to what's happening from the British Army in those early days of the Troubles. And in the years that follow, they realize this is absolutely not working. We have to change our tactics, change our approach. We need to have a completely different stance when it comes to how we're going to be in Northern Ireland. So, there were those some horrific incidents early on in the Troubles. And a lot of the time, these were British soldiers and commanders who'd been, they were using tactics, which they'd been using in places around the British Empire as it was falling apart and as the national independence movements were beginning to gain momentum. And they were just applying some of these tactics or adapting them for use in Northern Ireland, for use within the United Kingdom. And it didn't work. It led to some really unpleasant episodes.
But that was kind of like what the IRA and the kind of Irish patriots were kind of based on, is that the UK empire was giving up some of its global property. So maybe they thought this was their chance, right?
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and it was so interesting for me going through the government documents from the 70s and the 80s. And you begin to understand there that there's not within the British government this really sort of patriotic, passionate desire to hang on to Northern Ireland. It's not a question of principle so much as demographics. In other words, what makes Northern Ireland completely different from, let's say, I don't know, Kenya, is that the majority of people in Northern Ireland want to remain part of the United Kingdom. And that completely changes the situation. So it's not a colonial possession which the British government can just give up. And I think in terms of national self-determination, that's what makes us this particular region so different. And yeah, I think to begin with, there are people in the IRA who think this is the moment. Perhaps they'll forget about the demographics. Perhaps the government will just say, okay, we've given up so much other territory around the world. Let's do the same in Northern Ireland. But about 10 years in, it becomes really clear to certainly the likes of McGuinness and Adams that that is not about to happen, that the Northern Ireland is not seen as a colonial possession, and that they need a different approach.
Gotcha. And can you talk about, I mean, there's all these different operations. I mean, it's really like if you're studying intelligence and things like that, conflict, there's just so many different things, different operations, different techniques trying to be applied to hang on to. Can you talk about like Operation Chiffon or something else like that?
Yeah, sure. This is, so this comes later on in the book. And I mean, at the heart of this book is a question of who killed Frank Hegarty, who is this British agent that I've focused on. And there's this fascinating episode where one of the people who's suspected of having given the order is none other than Martin McGuinness. Martin McGuinness, who is also a Sinn Féin leader. He later becomes Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. Anyway, he's one of the people who's suspected of having ordered this particular killing. But the British also know that Martin McGuinness could be the key to bringing peace to the region. And he's someone who can bring parts of the IRA with him. He can persuade some of these really hardline militants to come with him and to push for a political compromise. Gerry Adams, not so much, that he doesn't quite have the trust of some of those hardliners. So the British know that Martin McGuinness is important. And Operation Chiffon begins after a conversation between someone working for MI6 and Martin McGuinness. And I love the story of how it came about. Maybe I'll save for the book the details of what happens, but it's an unexpected encounter. It's been engineered by a very close friend of this MI6, this British intelligence officer. And technically, this MI6 guy, when he finds himself in the same room as Martin McGuinness, who is at that time considered to be an IRA leader, someone that the British should not be speaking to. Technically, this MI6 officer should have just left the building straight away. So just said, I can't speak to you. This is my government's policy. I'm out of here. But he doesn't. He stays put. They talk. They continue to talk. And then 3 hours later, they're still talking. And this conversation is the beginning, really, of the peace process. And it's the beginning of something called Operation Chiffon, which is this undercover operation to try and bring about the start of a peace process to achieve a ceasefire in Northern Ireland from the IRA. And it all comes about, really, because of a friendship between Martin McGuinness and someone who knows an MI6 officer. But there then comes a point where the police in Northern Ireland, they've got enough information to put together a case against Martin McGuinness. So they think he's probably responsible for ordering the death of this man, Frank Hegarty. And they think they've got enough evidence that they want to press charges. However, MI5 are left with this incredibly difficult decision of, do we allow this prosecution to go ahead, or do we say, no, he has to be out of jail so the peace process can stand a chance of continuing.
What's remarkable is that these guys are still around. Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams and some of these other characters who were involved in the Troubles became kind of legitimized politicians. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, Martin McGuinness obviously is dead, but Gerry Adams is very much, he's, Gerry Adams is still around. And
he died in 2017, sorry.
Yeah. And, but yeah, you're right. It's fascinating that so many of the characters in this story, in this period of history, they are still around. And some of them are beginning to talk about what happened. Some of them, not so much. And Gerry Adams is certainly someone who let's just say, has not opened up fully about his past.
I can see why. I mean, there's a lot of things that went wrong. If there's it was 5,000 people that died overall. There was massive amount of like emotional damage, PTSD, scarred people from the conflict, right? Like there were the consequences were
about 3,500 people who died during the conflict and tens of thousands who were injured. And I think one of the saddest statistics I've heard is that more people took their own lives in the 20 years after the Troubles than were killed during the conflict itself. So there are deep, not just physical wounds, but also psychological wounds, which many people have had to carry. And look, I think the one thing that so many people I've spoken to have agreed upon is that for many people, the best way forward is to have a better understanding of what really happened, to have a clearer sense of the truth, and to get away from this culture of trying to hide everything, trying to cover everything up, and trying to just to bury the past. So there is more information coming out. I think that's a good thing. And I really hope Four Shots in the Night can be a small part of that.
Interesting. Yeah, it's a really interesting story. Not a lot of Americans know about it, but we see little pieces of it from music, U2, or hear stories or little, but this is a book that encapsulates all that. And we are at the 36-minute mark. I mean, is there anything you'd like to add or anything I missed? And where can people find the book?
I think we've given a good intro to the book. It's they can find it on, I mean, the usual suspects, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you name it, bookshop.org, they're good. And it's an audiobook, as you were saying earlier. It's an ebook. And it's available as of now.
Nice. Congratulations. And it's a really interesting audiobook. It's different than other ones. It's almost like obviously a professional voice actor, but you have it has a feel of an Irish feel, and you have Irish accents in there. So congrats on that. The best place to reach you also and look at your other books or find your other books is your website. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, that's absolutely. Yeah. HenryHemming.com.
Right. Last name is spelled HEMMING. So it's Henry Hemming, all one word. .com. And again, today we talked about, and kind of an introduction to the book, there's a lot more information, many more chapters. Full title of the book is Four Shots in the Night, A True Story of Spies, Murder, and Justice in Northern Ireland, just published in April 2024. And the author, again, is Henry Hemming. Thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It's been really good to be on the show.
Yeah, cool. Stay there.